Welcome to the Council of Better Business Bureaus podcast, Better Business, Better Series, where we will explore top-of-mind topics with business and industry leaders to understand the leading trends and innovations that continue to push the envelope in today's marketplace.
For the Better Business Bureau and the Better Business, Better Series, I'm your host, Will Johnson. January 28th is Data Privacy Day. Data Privacy Day is recognized in the U.S., Canada, and 47 European countries because of the growing importance of privacy and security in the online and mobile space. So today's topic is, how can companies and consumers work together in protecting your privacy and security, particularly around your most sensitive data? We're talking to two experts on ways to protect consumer information in online accounts, Bill Finelli, Chief Security Officer for the Council of Better Business Bureaus, and Francis Henderson, Vice President and National Director of Privacy Initiatives for the BBB. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
All right, let's start off with, first of all, while many of us might see them as being essentially the same, there's actually a real difference between privacy and security. Let's talk about that, why it's so important to understand.
So I'll start. Privacy is focused on authorized use of data. Security looks at unauthorized use of data. So what does that mean? I like to use examples. Let's look at a consumer with a free email account. So the first thing we want to talk about is, why is it free, right? So you get a service. What does the provider get? The provider gets to read your email. They have machines that read your email, and they use whatever they can glean out of your email to they use that data and sell it, primarily for targeted advertising. So you're giving up data. So let's talk then about the parties that are involved in this. You have the consumer who's getting a service and providing the data in their email. You have the email provider and their ad networks that they're providing that data to. And then you have bad actors who are going to try and steal that data. So security, which is my area of focus, really is looking at trying to keep the bad actors out. But privacy is where Frances focuses. I'll let her talk to that.
So privacy focuses more on how the consumer authorizes the email provider to use the data. In privacy, authorization can be either explicit or implicit. If you're logging into a service, you're going to have to explicitly agree. You'll pull up those terms and conditions that none of us like to read too closely.
Only lawyers.
And that's right. And you'll click I agree. And somewhere in those terms and conditions, there will probably be a privacy policy that actually explains to you how the email service is going to use your data. And they are supposed to notify you if they change that policy, if they change the uses of your data before they do that.
And you see that. You get emails every now and again that says, we're updating our terms and conditions along those lines, right?
That's right. And you're asked to agree again, usually.
Right.
So once you understand that you're actually authorizing an email provider or any other service provider or retailer that you interact with online to use your data, sometimes in unexpected ways, you have to consider, is it worth sharing your data in exchange for the benefit of that transaction? It might be worth it to you to get a free email service if you know that they are selling the content of your email. You might want to be careful what you put in your emails, but you have to give that some thought. Now, there are categories of data that you might want to be more concerned about sharing. And think about this cost-benefit analysis of sharing your data in exchange for a service or a product online. And I think most of us can consider what we think of as sensitive categories of data. Your social security number, your bank account information, obviously your credit card information, your driver's license, and increasingly, actually, your mobile telephone number, because that mobile phone contains an identifier. And as more and more of us do transactions on our mobile phones, our transactions and our data collection can be linked back to this phone number, to your phone, and to your identity. So you want to pause and think about, first of all, do you want to exchange your data for the service? Do you have to exchange your data from the service? Is it optional? And then as you're thinking about dealing with that online service or retailer, how are they going to protect your data once they have it? How long are they going to keep it? How are they going to protect it from unauthorized uses?
It's a tough position for a consumer to be in.
That's true. And really, I think what we would like to encourage is, maybe by default, I'm not going to give somebody my cell phone number, unless it winds up being that there's no way to get this service unless I provide it.
So that asterisk that says required field, I mean, you don't really have a choice if that's what they're asking for.
Right. And then you're in a position of saying, I can do this or I can't do it. You're right. Really stuck.
But I can drive around the corner and buy this item.
Right.
And let me ask as well, you mentioned email and what you put into an email, and this is a complicated area, of course, but when these servers and machines are scanning our emails, are they pulling out words and then serving ads based on those words or terms or phrases?
They actually are. They are capable of doing that. How closely they can link that information back to your personal identity is obviously a key question to consider. But because email is being scanned and because email is inherently insecure, it's always important not to put any critical information into an email. You don't want to put your bank account number into an email. You don't want to put your social security number into an email. All confidential information should be kept offline.
So what are the bad guys doing with our data? Is identity theft the main concern? Bank account access, these kinds of things, which you mentioned a little bit of.
Yeah, certainly identity theft is the biggest area of concern, and we'll speak to it some later on in terms of reuse of passwords. If I'm a bad guy and I get your password, there's a pretty good chance you've used that someplace else, so I'm going to pick it up. And even if it's your email password or your Google password, or I'm going to pick that up and try and log into 15 different banking sites because there's a pretty good chance you used it there too. But our focus here really is on the authorized use under privacy. Certainly anything that a bad actor does is unauthorized. For Data Privacy Day, I'd like to drive down that path of what's that authorized use and how are people we gave permission to use our data actually using our data.
So let's delve further into this topic of authentication, which basically is how you protect and access your online existence, in other words, logins. So the most obvious form of a login is using a password, which all of us do every day. Can we still feel comfortable in 2017 that a strong password can protect our data?
Well, So let's talk about passwords. If you've got really a strong password, it's going to do a pretty good job of protecting your data. The question then is, what's a strong password? Currently, the standard is about 8 to 12 characters. Don't make it a dictionary word. And absolutely, it needs to be a different password on every site.
And that's the tough one because we all try to remember, or not we all, but many of us try to remember maybe one password or two or three. Having a different one for every site gets complicated, but as you say, it's worth it.
It absolutely is. And so what can you do there? The first recommendation is to get a password manager so that you don't have to remember them all. You remember one good, really strong password, dig it into your password vault, and then it remembers all the rest of them. Kind of a next tier is you absolutely have to have one password that you use for your bank account, a different password that you use for email. And if you use the same password for everything else, that's bad, but it's not as nearly as bad as if you use the same password on your email and your bank accounts.
Okay, so email, bank accounts, credit cards, different. The big ones that will affect your pocketbook and your privacy on a very substantial level.
And the email is very important because I can usually, if I get into your email account, I can usually reset the password on every other account. So your email is very, very important.
And that's because if you're like me and you routinely forget the password that you've set on all these minor accounts that you might use across the internet, you click, forgot my password, you enter your email address, and they shoot that password right to you, to your email.
So the problem is that a lot of people use really bad passwords, to put it bluntly, or weak passwords, ones that they might even think are strong ones. And some actually really interesting statistics on this. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so I can use really strong passwords, but the reality is most people don't. Security experts have gone through the data breaches that you've seen published, and in those data breaches are long lists of passwords. So there's a billion email addresses and names and passwords that are out there from a recent data breach, and these guys have looked through them and found out that between 80 and 95% of online accounts can be accessed using a list of just 1,000.
80 to 95%. I mean, that's astonishing.
It is. And it's, I mean, there's only so many dog names and people use their pet names as their password and they think that's unique. Separate from the fact that I can, if I can get to your Facebook account, I probably know the name of your dog. There's not a long list of dog names.
That's interesting. So there's really, I mean, a set number, as you say, 1,000 that a lot of people are using.
Yep.
Same pets, same dog names, same cat names.
And changing, you know, E's to 3's is, you know, 10 years ago was useful, but, you know, that's what the bad guys expect now. And so that isn't a big help.
What about changing your password on a regular basis? Is that suggested?
What's more important is a strong password. Changing your password is a good idea. You know, in an ideal world, from a pure security perspective, if everybody used 20-character passwords that were random and changed them every 30 days, that'd be great. But I know nobody's going to do that, so I'm not going to ask you to do things that are going to cause you to use Sandy 1972 as your password.
Right. It has to be something that's going to work for people. Otherwise, it just gets impossible.
So as a kind of a public policy, we really need to encourage people to start using a different technology that's intrinsically stronger than
passwords. So let's talk about moving to a stronger technology. What is that technology? And tell us about it.
The improved technology for authentication to replace passwords is what's referred to as two-factor authentication. The Better Business Bureau is involved with a White House campaign that's Lock Down Your Login. You can find details on at lockdownyourlogin.com. It's focusing on the vendors out there that have this two-factor authentication available in their products and giving you instructions on how to turn it on.
So we should feel more comfortable immediately if you're working with a bank or a financial agency, whatever it may be, that has this two-step verification.
Yes, in general. It can be done better in some places than others, and we can talk about that a little bit. But perhaps what we should talk about what two-factor authentication
Please.
Is. So two-factor authentication says there's a list of three things, and I want you to present two of them. Something you know, something you are, or something you have.
Something you know, something you are, something you have.
Right. Something you know is a password. If I give you a username and a password, then I'm telling you something that theoretically nobody else knows. If I give you a fingerprint or let you scan my retina or look at my face, that's something I am that's unique to me. So that's a second factor. The third is something I have. So do I have some token, something I'm carrying around that identifies me?
So let me try and clarify authentication a bit. It's not always clear to all of us how that works. When you're logging into your email account, you're trying to authenticate to the email a vendor that you are who you say you are. You're logging in, you're giving them your known email address, and then you're giving them that password that you dreamed up, whether it's good or it's bad. And that's sort of a first step of authentication. And so when we're talking about strong authentication or two-factor authentication, we're talking about adding one more element to make it more secure.
That's correct. So passwords demonstrate that I told you I was Bill Finelli, and that's how I prove that I really am Bill
Finelli. That's who you are. Yep.
But the problem is passwords have become too easy to either steal or guess, and so we need something more. We want to always start with something you know, but we're going to layer on one of either something you have or something you are. So if I have my phone with me, the system can send me a text message that's got a code, and then if I put that code in, that proves that I have my phone.
And we're all getting, many of us are getting more familiar with that process of getting the code and putting that in, and that feels good. Let me jump ahead to cell phones and mobile phones, if that's all right. We enter a new world of authentication with mobile devices, and that's the use of fingerprints. You mentioned retina scans earlier, but I think at this point in time, most of us are familiar with fingerprints and not retina scans.
Correct.
So fingerprints and biometric data seems to be a step up from the use of a password and two-step verification. But with this technology comes an avalanche of new issues and potential threats to our privacy. So let's talk about that.
Sure. So fingerprint by itself is sort of a half step. If you're using just a fingerprint and using that instead of a password, you're using a stronger mode of authentication, but you're still using just a single mode of authentication. So we wouldn't call that two-factor.
It's not actually a step up.
Well, it is a step up in that it's much harder for somebody to steal your fingerprint or guess your fingerprint. It is much stronger than a password, although it's got a lot of privacy issues, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes. But it doesn't make it all the way up to two-factor. Now, if I said a lot of phones if you say, for instance, I want to log into my phone and I've set it up to use a fingerprint, if it's just a fingerprint that gets me on my phone, that's a single factor with something much stronger than a password. But you can also set up your phone to say, well, after the fingerprint, prompt me for a 4-digit code. And now that's something I am, my fingerprint, and something I know, the code. So that is truly two-factor, and it's much, much more secure.
A lot of us might not be patient enough to do the two steps, but it's probably worth it. If you're just going to choose one, is the fingerprint more important, perhaps, than 4 digits? It seems like 4 digits isn't all that much.
Well, it depends on which person at the table here you're talking about, okay?
Well, let's talk to both of you.
Okay, so from purely a security perspective,
right,
a fingerprint is much stronger than a password, although it has a bunch of interesting technology problems of it's much easier to replace your password than it is to replace your fingerprint if it gets compromised. I'll turn over to Francis
security
to talk
is,
about the privacy side of it.
Right, sorry, but privacy is a different issue once you've given your fingerprint over.
Right. So we were talking earlier about doing a little cost-benefit analysis when you decide to turn over your data to any kind of provider. And when you start talking about data that relates to your person, that is impossible for you to recapture once you've lost it, then you want to be thinking pretty hard about the privacy considerations that attach to a biometric data. And so in the context that Bill is talking about, where you're using biometric data on your own phone, then you probably can be assured, but you want to be assured that the mobile phone provider is actually storing that fingerprint on your own phone. You're not actually giving it over to anybody. It's being stored there and nobody else can get access to it. The use of biometrics in other situations is more questionable. Some companies are using them to boost their own security and to facilitate their transactions, essentially using biometrics fingerprints when they previously would have used photo IDs, for example. That's something that is helpful to the company. It's something that you, again, as an individual, or if you're there with your family, you might want to consider whether that's a good use of biometric data. So you always want to be asking, who's benefiting from this use of the data? Is it benefiting me? And is the risk I'm taking in turning it over a reasonable risk to assume in order to protect myself and my own data?
Okay. Tying into that idea of where fingerprint data is stored, we spoke previously before this interview about the example of a gym club in Access with a fingerprint. And the question there is, do people know, and they should certainly care, where that fingerprint is being stored, as you've just spoken of?
Right. So both from a privacy and a security perspective, I really want to know where that fingerprint is being stored. My phone, it's being stored locally. If I go to a gym and it's got 7 locations and I can access any one of them by scanning just my fingerprint, then you know that that's being stored at some central location. And there's one place that has every member's fingerprint data.
So some bad guy gets into that.
Right.
And they've got a lot of fingerprints.
Exactly. That's the concern.
It's, potentially it's, next to a name.
Right.
And more information.
And so it's a much, it's like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is, right? So it's a much more enticing target for a bad guy to steal a data bank of thousands of fingerprints than trying to work on getting into thousands of phones and stealing one at a time.
Let me wrap up here with, what are some new trends or upcoming innovations that you see shaping the role of data privacy in our lives?
Well, probably the biggest area is what we're calling Internet of Things. It certainly starts with smartphones, but then
the idea there being that the Internet is sort of taking over the world around us, and it's the way we are staying connected and using the Internet.
And there are many more things that you have on the Internet. So
right.
Typically I talk about the Internet being my computer and how I connect to it. But now suddenly my thermostat is on there. I may have a nanny cam at home. These are all wonderful things, but you've got to really be aware of how much data is being given up there. Now, it's not typically the traditional data that Francis talked about before of your social security number or even your phone number, but your thermostat is monitoring when you turn the heat up and when you turn the heat down.
Knows when you're there.
It knows when you're there. If somebody gets hold of that data, they know when you're there.
Well, we don't want to scare anybody, but it's a little scary, or maybe more than a little. And the idea here is that if we're all a little smarter and know a little bit more, we check out the Lock Down Your Login campaign, inform ourselves, and listen to...
And all of those things apply to the Internet of Things just as well.
All right, Bill Finelli is Chief Security Officer for the Council of Better Business Bureaus, and Francis Henderson is Vice President and National Director of Privacy Initiatives for the BBB. Thanks so much for talking to us today, and make sure you subscribe to the Better Business Better series. Stay listening to stay on top of business trends and innovations that are shaping the way you do business today. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the Better Business Bureau and the Better Business Better series, I'm your host, Will Johnson.
You just enjoyed Better Business Better Series podcast. Be sure to tune in next month for a brand new episode. To learn more about our other shows, visit betterbusiness.blueberry.com. That's betterbusiness.blueberry.com and subscribe. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the Better Business Bureau, Council of Better Business Bureaus, or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Blueberry's Terms of Service.